This is Lynn Benton Tractor's Newsmakers with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne. Presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Live, local talk that matters to you. Now, here's Brent and Dave from the Capital Auto Group Studios, exclusively on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
And welcome to Newsmakers. This is Brent DeHart. Dave Bourne is on vacation this week. It is Tuesday, and that means we're going to welcome Mayor Chuck Bennett of the City of Salem and hit some topics, learn something new about what's going on at the city. And later in the hour, after the mayor leaves, I have some things to talk about having to do with House Speaker Tina Kotek. I heard her speak, and I've mentioned this a few times, but some of the things that the goals of the dominant party in the legislature want to get accomplished and how they plan to do so, especially as it revolves around affordable housing and some of those bills and how to manipulate the market with legislation. So we'll talk about that as well. In the meantime, we've got a couple things to talk about with the mayor. So welcome, Mayor Bennett.
Thank you, Brent. It's glad to be here.
Nice to have you in the studio, and I appreciate the time.
Excuse me.
So right off the top, let's remind everybody that tomorrow is Breakfast with the Chief.
Yes, 7 a.m. over at the Convention Center. It's an opportunity to thank the chief, who I've got to say one more time is just simply the best police chief in the United States. He's just done such a great job here in Salem. He's been our police chief. He's been our chief for years and in the department his entire career. So it's a chance to celebrate him. What it is, too, is the big fundraiser for the Police Foundation, the annual fundraiser. And one of the things that'll be really exciting tomorrow is, I think, an opportunity to get a very close-up look at the new command center, which was bought by the city and the foundation. The command center is kind of a purpose-built motorhome-looking vehicle that is so high-tech and so complete, it can operate as essentially the police department center from this vehicle.
Right.
It's really interesting to see. Very, very exciting. What it amounts to in some ways, we've been talking about what do you use it for besides those events where you need a mobile command center. It's a precinct on wheels, and we can drive it into any neighborhood, and you have essentially a precinct office or department in your neighborhood. So kind of, I know some of us on the council are kind of looking around where would be a good place to have a precinct.
So this is a mobile command center.
Yeah,
it's really ultimately designed for when catastrophe strikes and communications are messed up. And we did have emergency preparedness discussion here on Newsmakers and, you know, how you have to be able to get around and you have to be able to communicate.
Yep.
And all those things. And this thing is not cheap. This is $700,000?
At least.
Would it exist without the Police Foundation?
No.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, and they have just done the foundation through its president, Dan Wellert, have just worked very hard. They do work constantly with the police department. They work very hard for raising funds for this. They were instrumental in passing the bond measure for the new police center here in Salem. It's an outstanding organization. It's one of those, if you want to support your local police, this is the place to go.
Yeah, and it astounds me that this is an organization that's just 8 years old. And we had them on the show, and it's how much they've accomplished in those 8 years, raising the money for new canines, training canines. And this is a big-ticket item. This is huge.
This is a very big deal.
So anytime people are looking ahead, I applaud that. You know, sometimes things happen nationwide at all sorts of communities, be they, you know, the Midwest or the South. Southeast or, and you're like, why didn't you plan for that? You can't account for everything. You can't account for a once in 2000 year storm kind of thing. But some things it's like, really, you're not ready. And we were in that situation before the fire bond, as you recall,
where
we wouldn't have had emergency power in our own fire stations in case of a catastrophe. Some of them would have been lost and our fire engines crushed under an earthquake because we weren't up to code. And so doing all these things to plan for what if in a catastrophe. It was nice to have Marion County emergency manager here.
Oh,
talked
great.
About the airport. Yeah. We talked about how that needs to be a center for getting emergency goods and individuals in and out. And of course, we talked a little bit about the bridge.
Yeah.
But, and then
well, that's
the necessity to get. And it was striking.
Sometimes we look backward, don't we?
It was pretty frank. He wasn't, you know, stumping or campaigning. He just frankly said for infrastructure, he says, in the case of a Cascadia event, the earthquake event that we know is coming, it's not if, it's when.
Yep.
They say, hey, we can fly in the Red Cross and blood supplies and water and this and that, but we're going to have a heck of a time getting across the river.
Well, in a Cascadia event, along with the problem with bridges, which I think we're going to be seeing all of our bridges, both bridges gone and or in serious trouble. Our street system will be in trouble. Our water system will be in trouble. That's why I, in my State of the City, said I'm going to be convening a task force on resiliency. We really need to get ahead of this and begin to catalog and understand where our deficiencies are. And I think we do know some of them. I don't think we know all of them, and I don't think we have a plan for dealing with all of them. And this came up the other night in the bridge discussion. A resident got up and talked about Katrina, and it really reminded me the responsibility that we have as a city to at least understand where we're deficient so citizens can evaluate both whether we're doing what we need to be doing and whether or not they want to help participate in it, because all this stuff's pretty expensive.
Yeah, so we did learn last summer that I think everyone got heightened awareness about our vulnerability for drinking water.
Drinking water is big. I'll tell you, one of the things people have been kind of counting on is we're going to repair the Center Street Bridge to an earthquake standard. Well, I got word last night that we'd been talking about, and I think had been allocated somewhere between $40 and $60 million for that project by the state sometime in the next 5 years. No, it's going to be, we really need somewhere closer to $80 to $100 million to pay for that project. It just keeps going up in cost.
It's a new bridge,
and it's not clear anything can be done about the Marion Street Bridge. So we've got some deficiencies which are sort of self-imposed, and now we've got to come to grips with them and how we're going to deal with them.
Well, after you're gone, I'll go on a little rant about people that don't plan for the future.
Okay.
So I don't have to put
please
you
don't include.
That.
I'm really, I really hope that's one of the things we'll be doing during this term.
Well, I was thinking on the way to studio today about how Salem is not like the rest of the country, and you were mentioned Chief Moore. What a great job he's been doing for decades now in Salem. And Salem is not like the rest of the company in its relations to with the police department, his reputation of the police department, and so forth. And, you know, that is to be celebrated. So kudos to you, Chief. We'll have you back on Newsmakers soon. Breakfast with the Chief tomorrow and the unveiling of the new command center, which is pretty remarkable. We're going to talk to we're going to switch gears entirely and talk to the mayor a little bit about the park system, another aspect of quality of life. That sometimes we either take for granted or we're frustrated and we really don't know about. So we're going to ask the mayor about the challenges of funding them, of building them, and maintaining them. Stick with us. We're talking to Mayor Chuck Bennett of the City of Salem on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This is Lynn Benton Tractor's Newsmakers with Brent and Dave, presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Now, let's go back to the Capital Auto Group studios on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
And welcome back to Newsmakers. This is Brent DeHart for Dave Horn, who's on vacation this week. We are talking with Mayor Chuck Bennett of the City of Salem. We're going to talk a little bit about bridges. We talked about bridges enough. We're going to talk about parks. Parks is a huge issue in quality of life. There's so many aspects about it, and we're just going to touch the surface, and we'll probably have to have the Public Works Director on to dive deep. Yeah. But there's so many things that people should understand in terms of how you compare city to city and how much parkland, what counts, what doesn't count, the classification of parks. So you have a neighborhood park. So if you live in a neighborhood in Salem, within a certain radius, you're supposed to have a park that you can walk to.
That's right.
And they're supposed to be of a certain size range and of a certain development level in terms of what its amenities are and so forth. And then you have larger parks, and then you have regional parks like Bush, Riverfront Park, right? Mm-hmm. Minto Brown. And Wallace Marine. Three different classifications. And I remember that I was on the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board. Even after I was a city council, and we talked a lot about these things. And you learn a lot in terms of people will actually argue about what should be accountable in terms of recreational space.
Yeah.
And do you count all of Minto Brown's hundreds of acres in our green space and so forth? At any rate, anything in news as far as new parks coming up, if people should look for in their neighborhood that's that's already on the calendar?
Well, I think part of it is just keeping track of what is planned. Each park has a master planning session that goes on with it. I think the big one that I've seen lately that's really getting going is McKay. Mm-hmm. And then Brown Road is another park. We just recently, within the past couple of years, purchased 6 acres over at the old state hospital site that has been used traditionally as kind of a ballpark, whether it's soccer or baseball or rugby. And
is that north of center?
It is north of center. It's on D Street, about D and 25th.
Okay,
about 6 acres. Each year, the city brings on a park. Has been sort of the strategy that has gone on. It's all done under our Public Works Department. And I'll tell you, have you ever played SimCity? Have you ever done SimCity? This always makes me think of it. Years ago, I was doing it, and I noticed every time you located a park, the little SimCity people cheered. And that's it gives you a sense of I think, how everybody feels when you get a park going. And I think the other thing that happens is there's a lot of activity in upgrading the various parks. The big visible ones are like Riverfront or over at Wallace Marine, even over at Minto Brown or Bush Park. Those big, like you say, big kind of regional parks are where we see the big changes. But the neighborhoods, volunteers, the Parks Department do a tremendous job of consistently upgrading local parks. And a lot of that is done through the budget process, through the Parks Foundation, through volunteer activity. And I think it makes the parks very vibrant and really locally owned. Mm-hmm. I think it's one reason, if you're not involved with your neighborhood association and you care about your local park, try to put those two together, because the neighborhood associations become tremendous advocates for Park Foundation money and for city money for parks. The big one, as you know better than I do, the big issue with parks, we do have money through systems development charges for buying land, mm-hmm. and we do buy land. We do take opportunity to buy land for parks. But it's the cost of planning them, developing them for use, and then maintaining them. And those issues become very expensive. They're generally not capital, particularly the maintenance side. So it's difficult to raise money for them. So it's a constant process.
So somebody's living in a neighborhood, and there's a sign across the street that says future site of a neighborhood park, and it hasn't been developed for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Explain that to them.
Well, There just has not been money in place for that park yet. And I think one thing people ought to do, if it were me, I would talk to my city councilor as to why is that the situation in my neighborhood. I know as a 9-year city councilor, I was able to get parks open, but I was a real squeaky wheel. And I think that's really important. And I think a lot of it is getting your neighborhood association and your city councilor really advocating for that park to be opened. I don't know how many of those now exist out there where you have the sign that has begun to rust and fall apart that says this will be the future site of a park. But it certainly is, if not real, it's an urban myth. It's a perception, and I think it's something that we all pay attention to. So if anyone out there has one of those signs, if you can't get your counselor interested, your mayor's very interested, let me know at the mayor's office, and I'll go to work on it for you.
All right, that sounds good. I lived in an area town, and it was Neighborhood Park, and it was one of those signs that was up. I bet it was up for 20 years.
Yeah.
Future home of C-Corp Park, and I've moved from the neighborhood, so I don't even know if it was ever developed. But
well, it wasn't while you were counselor that was a problem. Whoever's there now is.
I kind of liked it in its natural state, and it was adjacent to a school, so people had, you know, some amenities. But
well, and there are reasons too, and I know the Parks Department has begun doing this, is essentially opening those areas, making them available with walkways and things, and they kind of are nature parks, but it's giving people an open space to use until you get the swings or whatever you're going to do in terms of developing the park. Some folks actually just prefer having, like you say, a more natural area, but they'd like to also have a trail through it so they can see it.
All right. Well, let's explain to the listener how this money happens. So let's say a new neighborhood is going in because of growth. In South Salem, West Salem, of course, in recent years. The developer pays SDC, system development charges, for parks and along with other things. And then the city can use that money, but only as it relates to growth. That's the state law restriction.
Yeah.
You can only use these charges as it relates to growth. So some of these parks, they were already there, and now they need to be developed. And there's going to be a formula that determines how much of this is related to growth and how of it was pre-existing this SDC charge. So that's where the money issue is, all right? That's where the log jam is.
Yeah, it's one of the areas. What we have is money in place. We have money in place to buy land, really is what it amounts to. We can purchase property for parks. The real issue comes as you want to develop them, as you want to improve the land for parks, and then when you want to put amenities onto the parkland. And keep it mowed, and keep it watered, and keep, you know, whatever it takes.
And that's general fund money.
Then it becomes general fund money. And we do not have, like, a parks levy that helps keep that, kind of create that constant flow of cash. So they go in, the parks go in and compete with the library, police, fire, planning, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you begin that competition, it becomes a real priority as to what is the most important thing. And I will tell you that most commonly the council responds is public health, safety, and welfare. And then there are other factors that come into play. But we try very hard to keep it balanced, to keep ahead of our parks, and keep it moving in the right direction.
Mayor?
But it's hard.
Has the city in the last 10 years made any more inroads or made any efforts to either outsource some of the work so that maybe you can get it less expensively from the open market or the free market, or to utilize volunteers and enable them? I know back in the day, there was some frustration where we were told, no, you can't mow your own you know, Little League field or your practice field. And actually say no to volunteers. Have we gotten better?
I think we're better. It certainly has been from when you were on the council up till now. I think there's been a fairly constant push by the council to continue to make that available to the public to work on if they're able. What we found in terms of outsourcing into the private sector, it's not clear it's cheaper to do it that way. Volunteers are volunteers. Volunteers also need supervision. We need people to work with volunteers. So to help them figure out what to do, I mean, you can say, come on out, mow the park. Well, huh? What part of this gets mowed? What part doesn't? So it does take still some direction from the city, but I think we're doing better with that. I know, I'll give you a great example, the tremendous support Mission Street Parks group is having over at Bush's Pasture Park. And they're using private, they've done quite a bit of work, and I think they'll be unveiling it here pretty soon in various parts of Bush's Pasture Park. And that's being done by private contractors with this organization that is raising money to support the park and providing some really great insight into what that park needs at various times. So I think we're headed in the right direction. Plus, not every park attracts volunteers.
Yeah.
That's just one of the realities. I don't think we do as good a job at recruiting as we should, but we also don't always get folks who are invested in their local park.
And I know some people are passionate about trails, and they'll go in and help put the trail in help maintenance.
My local park is Englewood. Over at Englewood School. And I tell you, there's a group of people that just work on that park constantly. And really impressive what they're doing. And it's through the Neighborhood Association in many ways.
I have another mayor question for you.
Okay.
There's some, you talked about how you can buy the land, perhaps with system development charges, SDCs. And then we have all these examples that it takes years and years to really accumulate the money to get it developed. Is our process, this is a twofold question.
Okay.
Is the process to go through the master planning and the construction too complex? I mean, should it be, I don't want to say rubber stamped, and I don't want to say cookie cutter, but could it be streamlined and simplified? And the second question is, believe it or not, the developer that's developing the housing around it, they don't want a future park that's fallow, that's overgrown, that's not attractive. They'd just as soon put in a circle trail or a trail around the perimeter and at least make it look like it's green space. Can we let's bring it up not to full development standards, not to full master plan standards, but to utilization standards? So that's two questions. Doing the halfway mark when you don't have the money yet, and can we simplify and make it less expensive a process?
Yeah, I, and the answers are yes. I think that we have to make sure that public expectations are met, that it is a park, that it is available and people can get at it, and that there are things to do in it, like walking or running or whatever. I think you over the years have talked about this quite a bit, and I think they've heard you over the years talking about it. I certainly agree with you. And what they're doing are essentially opening these pieces of land with low-impact uses, low-cost uses, and it's mainly keeping trails open, keeping it cleaned, basically cleaned up, or working with a group of people to help keep it cleared of any junk that might arrive. And I think that's going on. Now, whether or not how common developers doing work on the parkland that might be near them, I don't know. I really don't. And I'll ask. I'm just not sure. So often, the way that developers are involved in park development really is pay the fee, the systems development charge. That money's then aggregated and at some point used to either purchase land is the most common that I've seen. Now, there may be others, but that's the one I've seen most commonly.
Well, we're going to have to say goodbye to the mayor. So many other things to talk about. Maybe we'll wrap up the conversation on parks after he goes. But I do want to get to some of the speaker's comments the other day.
Well,
mayor,
thank you
being with us. Appreciate it. And hopefully we'll see you next Tuesday.
Well, you will.
A couple more weeks before you go on vacation.
That's true.
All right. We're going to take a break. This is Newsmakers on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
Lynn Benton Tractor's Newsmakers, presented by Les Schwab Tires, continues in the Capital Auto Group studios. Here's Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
And welcome back to Newsmakers. This is Brent DeHart. Dave is on vacation. And I just want to wrap up the conversation we're having with Mayor Bennett about parks and how they get funded or not funded and how the hitch occurs in your neighborhood. A few things really quickly, because I do want to get to some of the bills that are in the legislature that are also going to affect us, as laid out in some of the priorities by House Speaker Kotek. All right, so neighborhood park we're talking about. So that developer or home builder and ultimately the home buyer, they're all paying into the system, pile called SDC, System Development Charges. It can be only paid for the percentage of which was impacted by growth. Well, then you have a situation where a park might cost $1 million to develop, say, for an example, and it's only 80% qualified as SDC qualified. So what that means is the pile of money that is there and it's in the bank, you can only use, you know, $800,000, but you need $1 million, which means you have to come up with $200,000 sitting around in cash that is not already dedicated to the library or the police or the fire and all these other needs. So then there's a hitch. Is there money in the general fund to do the rest of the development? And then you're going to bring online maintenance costs. Is it money in the budget in the general fund to take on the maintenance costs of a new park in the system that's going to be ongoing? So that's the hitch. And my point to the mayor about making the system a little bit more streamlined and easier is maybe we don't need to spend so much time reinventing a park and going through the master plan process every time we're doing a 5-acre park. At any rate, so that's the hitch, folks. And if you have one of those in your neighborhood that says it's been promising you a neighborhood park for the last 10, 15, 20 plus years, as Mayor Bennett's advice was, call your counselor and see if you can get in line. See if you get in line. They tend to try to spread it out throughout the city. So try to get your voice heard. Other funds for parks such as Minto Brown. If you're a Minto Brown visitor and you've seen all the changes in the last 5 years or so with the paved and widening of paths and signs and Wayfarer signs, a lot of that money came from the federal government, of course, which comes with strings attached. And you have to do things the way the federal government wants you to. But there has been, that's the trade-off. So now we've got a bridge to this extensive trail system, links to a county park and so forth. Anyway, so many things about that, and perhaps we'll have the Public Works Director on, Mr. Peter Fernandez. We'll invite him back. So thanks for being with us today on Newsmakers. We're going to start diving in a little bit about what I've been teasing about with Senator Kotek. And she spoke to a local group. She talked about some of their priorities, which is not a surprise. Their priorities are to lower carbon emissions. So that's with a cap and trade that we've been talking about. Affordable housing is a huge one of their priorities, and of course, funding for schools. And then narrowing into the affordable housing, there's a whole bunch of things being floated around to try to make it easier to have more density, which means more living dwelling units in the same area. So one of the zoning laws, and mind you, we're talking about the state legislature, and these are things that are really under the purview of a city and each and every city in the state of Oregon. And once the legislature grabs it, you know, a lot of times they run afoul of what the League of Oregon Cities wants because they don't want to be preempted in how they zone their city, right? So we saw a headline a month ago about the concept of having no single-family housing zones, which raised a lot of ire. What that really means is they want to require each city to allow in a single-family zone, you can't just have single-family. You have to also allow some semblance of duplexes, triplexes, quads, multifamily, or something like that. This is a long from a done deal, but the concept, it really is we're going to have diversity. We're going to have diversity, the panacea of everything in our neighborhoods, and so that we don't have such separation and we can put more density in the same number of acreage. Also in there is accessory dwelling units, one of those wonderful government acronyms, ADUs, which we've talked about on Newsmakers. And that's your mother-in-law quarters. I don't know. Maybe it's your servant's quarters. I don't have a servant's quarters, but maybe you have an adult child or an older parent or what have you, and you can have any. Or maybe you want a little rental. And you have a large lot. And I think you have the old large lots in Salem. Anyway, and of course, we've talked a little bit about rent control. So these are, in my opinion, largely Portland Metro issues that she and the party and the legislature is trying to overlay over the state. So some of these things just don't apply for Kaiser. They don't apply for Dallas. They don't apply for Scotts Mills and all these other things. It's like, I understand you have an issue in Portland. Some of it is of your own doing through regulation and legislation. And I see how it's a focus of theirs because they're representing Metro. But that doesn't mean it's a statewide issue. If anything, you know, you have to attach it to some sort of population base. And so that it doesn't apply statewide, and the fix, and other people are scratching their heads, and Medford's scratching their head is like, well, this is not really an issue down here, and so on and so forth. So that's part. It's a Portland solution that they want to overlay for the state. The other thing, and mind you, I thought the speaker did decently and about not hiding behind, and not even though her audience was not a typical supporter of, you know, her agenda, she didn't hide what the agenda was. No reason to, but she was pretty frank. She talked about having economic diversity in neighborhoods. Okay. I'm going to get myself in trouble here. Economic diversity in neighborhoods. So people of different economic statures, different incomes, and so forth can all live together and have this diverse interblending and so on and so forth. Right away, I think of Illahee neighborhood because it's affluent. Right? I don't think there's too many people that live in the Illahee neighborhood that are on food stamps. I don't think that's the case. So then I get that you don't want to create slums. However, here's Brent's take. I make a certain amount of money and it ranges. I don't really want to live around people that make 10 times as much money as I do. I don't shop for the same cars. I don't go on the same vacation. I don't have the same first word problems they do. Not that I dislike them. I mean, it's often mistaken that, oh, that must be hate-filled. And it's like, we tend to hang around with people that share our value system and that we have something in common with. So maybe I don't like the sports, whatever it is. You know, you can't talk about, oh, well, how do you like your $150,000, you know, car? I can't relate. It's cool. I mean, I look at it. But for me, this is them telling me and telling us what we all should want. I don't want to live in economic diversity. I'm not that comfortable around people who are making 10 and 20 and 100 times what I make. That's just not my people. All right. Unfortunately, when you say the flip side, that's when you're a hater. I do also don't have a lot in common with people that make a tenth of what I make. So does that make me hate them? Does that make me the man and wanting to keep them down? Or does it, you know, people tend to congregate about people that they have something in common. I'm a middle class guy. Although when I read what their idea of middle class is, I sometimes wonder if I even qualify. But that's the issue. It's like they assume that everybody should want. And when you talk about that kind of societal programming, I'm not really with you. I'm not really with you. Some of these other ideas are creative, and they're making things. They're enabling. So to have creative zoning, as long as it's not mandated by the state but permitted by the state, what a city can do. All right, give them more options. Accessory dwelling units for infill. All right, give them more options. Mandating some of these things and assuming that the goal should be economic diversity. Economic diversity in your neighborhoods. To a certain degree, it's not an evil thing. It's not a bad thing, but really social programming. Let us congregate. I think that's one of those constitutional things that they also seem to forget is we have right of free association. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break and have one more segment. You're listening to Newsmakers, your local place for talk in Salem-Keizer on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This is Lynn Benton Tractors Newsmakers with Brent and Dave, presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Now, let's go back to the Capital Auto Group studios on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
And welcome back to Newsmakers. This is Brent DeHart, and we want to finish up a conversation about Speaker Kotek's appearance in the community a week or so ago, and how it relates. Frankly, this is all related to our quality of life and our pocketbooks, right? It's what Newsmakers is all about in our region, things that are going to affect our quality of life and our pocketbooks and how we live, work, play here in the Willamette Valley. The other issue on having to do with affordable housing is she was told that if by the time you've got a nice buildable lot that has been leveled, if it's in the hills and so forth, and it's got utilities and you've paid your SDCs, your system development charges, to the jurisdiction like the city, you might be in it, or the home builder might be in it, for $140,000. And how do you build an affordable house or a workforce house? How do you build a starter home when you haven't brought the first 2x4 to the property and you're in it for $140,000? And how do you bring that cost down? So she talked about some of those things and actually posed the question. There were two very good questions asked. One was, and we talked about it last week, is the question of, well, what's affordable and how are you going to define that? And of course, there is no definition. So anybody who can throw out buzzwords, it's like that pay your fair share. Well, everybody has a different idea what the fair share is. It doesn't mean anything, nor is it defined. And affordable is not defined, except in some cases where they have qualifications for building workforce or affordable housing. All right. So the one question is, what is affordable? In her mind, if people are spending more than 30-ish percent of their income on housing, then it becomes less and less affordable. And certainly, and this was a statistic that was noteworthy, how many people, I think it's 25% of people in some areas, are spending over half their income on a roof over their head. That's unaffordable, unsustainable. Okay, I can go with that definition. Here's the thing. You can't really figure out how to bring it down. I'm like, well, why don't you lower regulations? Why don't you permit this, allow this, and so forth? And my question was, doesn't the cost of the land go down when there's more of it? It's not like the earth is creating anymore, except in Hawaii, of course. But the supply, and we talked about this with Mayor Clark of Kaiser last week, the supply inside the urban growth boundary, again, metro is a different situation than our area, our Eugene. But if you allow for more buildable inventory, if there's more inventory, the cost of each lot goes down. That's kind of simple to figure out. And can you make it, Mrs. Speaker, can you make it less onerous to go through a process to expand the urban growth boundary and create more buildable space? That's going to bring the cost down. So the same thing, and we talked about this, you might have missed it, but we talked about how regulations in the city of Portland having to do with zoning and inclusion zoning pretty much killed the construction of multifamily housing in Portland. And then, lo and behold, they have this huge crisis where there's not enough apartments and the cost to rent in Portland skyrockets. Well, you killed the industry by trying to do something good that ultimately doesn't pencil. That's why you have to take into account and discuss with people in the industry, because if no one's going to make money because of the regulation, no one's going to do it. People don't go out and risk all the money and borrow from the bank to build an apartment if ultimately they're not going to make any money. So that's a situation where regulations created the crisis. And so regulations, or the lack of regulations, should be able to reduce the impact of that crisis. And I just don't see it. So they want $2 billion in new taxes for schools. All right. So this is the follow the logic, right? So I'm saying to get more affordable houses, get more affordable housing, and get rents lowered so people can afford them, you can have more supply. You can subsidize it with taxpayer dollars. Well, that's always a good idea. Or you can help people have more income so they can afford the market rate rents. That part they never consider, right? Unless it's minimum wage, and then minimum wage is not designed to support a family of four. And I will probably, on Newsmakers, rant a full hour on the distinction between those two public policy discussions. All right, here's the new. Here's how it relates to the, it's just a pattern of thinking. They want $2 billion, by they I mean the governor and the legislature, of new taxes, of course, to go to schools and so forth. All right, they want more money in taxes. There's one way to do it. You can just raise the rates. Everyone's paying a higher percentage. You pay higher amounts, higher rates. That raises it, right? Instead of paying 9% taxes, you pay 11% taxes and they have more money. That's one method. The other is to have new taxes, right? We talked about that. Method number two, create a new tax that the public is not yet paying, and then they're going to have to pay. And one of the things being floated, of course, is the gross receipts tax. Again, even though it was voted down by voters not very long ago. And the third one seems foreign to them. The third way to have more tax revenue is to have more income in the state. Hello, more income in the state. Allow people to make more money so you can tax it. Create an environment where we have economic activity and industry that is profitable, that hires people, and people go to work and the wages go up, then there's more income in the state so that you can tax it. That's how you can get money for education. Hello? So crickets, and I'm still holding a grudge from Governor Kitzhaber. When he's governor, he wanted money for healthcare, money for schools. Okay, great. But then they shoot down proposals to use some of the Columbia River water in eastern Oregon for more agricultural use, like Washington is doing. Can't do that. Can't use the water. Fish might need to have a drink. And also, of course, even sustainable levels of our forestry in state lands and creating mill jobs and forest jobs and forest management jobs. And so we're not importing lumber from Canada. We live in Oregon and we import lumber from Canada. So more income. And I just wish, and that's my beef with that side of the aisle, is, you know, having people make money is not the problem. That's actually the solution to your public policy goals. More money for schools, more money for healthcare and Medicaid, more money for all of your goals, right? So, and we've had the teachers out demonstrating for more money for schools and so on and so forth. And you and I know a lot of the money that should be going into the classroom is going into the PERS retirement system, and what a mess that is. So the problem is we can raise all this money for schools and then it backfills PERS, and the PERS doesn't have a solution. There's no more fixing the mess it's in that hasn't already been fixed. So, wow, what a mess. Let's go back to allowing people to make more money and keep it. All right? All right. So we've got some good guests coming up this week. We're going to hear the state of the architecture business in Salem this week. So that should be fun. And we're going to hear from Senator Mike Nierman. So that should be fun. And if you have an idea for us, should be sure to pass it along at kyknewsmakers@gmail.com. You've been listening to Newsmakers, and have a great day. You've been listening to 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This has been Lynn Fenton Tractor's Newsmakers with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne, presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Live local talk that matters to you from the Capital Auto Group studios, exclusively on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.